Righty-o. Howdy, folks. Welcome along to Tea Tree Gully this morning. My name's Dave. For anyone I've not met before, it's good to be here with you. Please do grab your Bibles. Do open them up to page 907, which is where the Amos passage is. There's also an outline in the leaflet that hopefully you got when you came in that will let you follow along as we go as well. Now, there might have been some strange things for you as we read our way through that passage in Amos. What he's doing there, really, as he continues to lay out the accusations that he's making against God's people Israel, is he's painting a picture for us. He's painting a picture that puts us in a place that some of us may have never been or never would want to be, in a courtroom, and even more specifically, in the defendant's seat. After a lengthy trial, the evidence has been played out, and now the defendant is being told to stand and to receive the final sentencing. And that's what happens. That's what we see played out through this chapter. The charge is reread, the accusations are laid out in all their detail, and finally, the penalty is declared. Now, at the end of the day, that's not a seat that you want to be in, is it? You don't want to find yourself sitting there. It might not be a seat that we're willing to sit in. And I would wager that there would be at least some of us here this morning who are thinking something along the lines of, well, what gives anyone the right to sit in that kind of judgment over me? But that's what's happening here in Amos, and it's a word that God gives to Israel, but not just to Israel, to all his people throughout time to learn from. So what's actually happening here, and what's here for us in this message of judgment? Well, Amos starts the sentencing phase by identifying the defendants. Now, they are the wealthy women of Israel. He calls them cows, which is not a great start, really, if you're trying to win them over, but that's not what he's doing. Then he moves straight on to telling us something more about their, what they've done, and something about their character to us as well. Now, you see that all just laid out there in that first verse. Hear this word. He says, you cows of Bashan on Mount Samaria, you women who oppress the poor and crush the needy and say to your husbands, bring us some drinks. I know you get a sense of these people right from the start, don't you? They oppress the poor and the needy. Now, we got something of a sense if you were here last week about what that looks like. But in short, what that means is that they've become rich at the expense of other people. Other people have suffered. Other people have worked for them. Other people might live in poverty so that these ones could become rich. Now, you also get a sense of laziness, don't you? Self-indulgence from that last line. You could imagine them reclining back on the lounge, watching television all day, and every so often snapping their fingers to summon their husbands to bring out more wine. There's reality television shows that you can watch that detail these kinds of lives that some of the very wealthy live in our society. Not that we would watch such television shows as that. But it's not a flattering picture, is it, of these people? Now, it would be very easy for us to make a joke out of this. It's almost a caricature, isn't it, of decadence. And so the temptation might be either to have a go at them for being like that, or to try and defend that sense of entitlement to be treated like nobility. But both of those responses, either to attack or to defend, are unhelpful because they distract us from the position and the direction that the passage is taking, which is to accuse them, but also to warn us. Now, the point of the introduction is simply to level that accusation, to level the accusation against anyone who believes that their personal comfort is more important than justice to others being done. Now, that is a fairly familiar story in our society. You'll see that story all over the place within our culture. You'll see that story played out again and again through history. If you study history of more or less any country in the world, you'll be able to find past instances where the leadership of that country has gone too far in its oppression of their people, and the people have risen up in protest to overthrow their government. Sadly, more often than not, they find that the new one is every bit as oppressive as the last, if not worse. And it's a familiar story in our literature, isn't it? In our books, in our movies, in A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. It's the story of how the rich and cruel Scrooge, who cruelly treats his employees, is reformed by three ghostly figures one Christmas Eve. Or Victor Hugo's Les Miserables, it's the story of a popular uprising of the people of Paris who've been pushed down for too long against the nobility. But of course, that's a story that many of us ignore, the fact that that effort is wildly unsuccessful. Now, our culture throws up lots of these stories about people who have been oppressed wanting to stand against their powerful opposition. And if we're to read ourselves into those stories, where we like to place ourselves is as the defender of the weak, as the one who stands alongside those who are being oppressed. We are the good guys. We are the ones who are taking a stand for those who are hard done by and protecting them. But the danger is that while we might have noble intentions, while we might think this is the way that we go about life, it is all too easy to be one of the cows of Bashan. You see, the stick that we need to measure by is not to think that those are just the wealthy 1%. You know, they always exist somewhere else, the millionaires who hoard most of the world's wealth to themselves. He's not merely speaking to them. He is speaking to anyone who thinks that their comfort is more important than the rights of the poor and needy. And we heard last week just how simple, just how easy it is to be part of the oppression. I wonder how many of us know, without checking the tag at the back of our necks, where our clothes were made. I wonder how many of us know who made them, if we know what they were paid, if we know what their working conditions were like. Now, that information can be fairly hard for us to come by. You might think, well, how am I supposed to know that? It is hard to come by, but the reason that it's hard to come by is because nobody really cares, and so nobody really makes an effort to provide that information. The word of judgment here in Amos 4 is one that is directed against all those who value their own personal comfort above the treatment of others, and against those who value their leisure over their relationship to God. Now, this word of judgment could just as easily be directed against us. And so it's probably right that we read it with a little humility and a little caution. So what does Amos have to say? Where will he take the word from here? Well, we've heard the initial verdict. Now the divine judge moves on to describe the crimes, or at least he points back to what they have done. In the past, he says to his people, go to Bethel and sin, go to Gilgal and sin yet more. Now, again, immediately we look at that and there's a gulf, there's a space, a cultural space between what they're experiencing and our own culture. I imagine if I were to give you a map of Israel, there would be precious few of us who could put a pin in either of those places with any kind of precision without knowing or reading the name on the map. It's hard for us to understand what these references to ancient cities could have to do with life in 21st Australia as we live it today. So what is this all about? Now, Bethel, we've heard something about. If you were here last week, we heard about Bethel. We heard about the historical role that it had played throughout the ages as a place where God's people had encountered their God, or more specifically, a place where God had made himself known. He had appeared, had revealed himself to some way in to his people. And the name itself is a bit of a giveaway. The name Bethel means the house of God. But it's more than just the name. For the Israelites in Amos's day, it's what the name represents. You know, places can come to hold a significance that is even deeper than simply what they are called. And that significance is drawn from what has happened there in the past. So to pick an example from our time, if anyone here follows cricket, you would know that Lord's is considered the home of cricket. It's the ultimate place for that. If you follow tennis, it's the lawns of Wimbledon, isn't it, year by year? If you're into gardening, it might be the Chelsea Flower Show or something similar. Whichever world, whichever interest, whichever group you move in, there are places, there are times, there are events that hold this deep significance. You could think of others, I'm sure. That's what Bethel and Gilgal were to Israel. Right, Gilgal was the place where they had won their biggest victory in conquering the promised land. It had become a central gathering point for them where they had experienced some of their deepest moments of national identity. And Bethel, in the same way, was a place where God had come to meet with his people. It was where Israel had gathered on the edge of the promised land as they went in to take hold of their inheritance. It was the place where they had set up the 12 stones that they'd taken out of the Jordan River as they crossed across to remind them that their God was with them when they put their trust in him. It was a place where Israel could remember that unique relationship that they had with their God and their Creator. But it was also the place where the golden calf had been set up. And from there, idolatry had spread through the nation and had dragged them away. So what is the point of all this? Go to Bethel, he says. Go to Gilgal and sin. The places where they came to feel close to God had become the place where their sin, their abandonment of God, had reached its peak. Now, this is a deeply significant point in this chapter. So let's say it again. The place where Israel had come in order to feel close to God had become the place where their abandonment of God was strongest. Now, Gilgal, Bethel, they mean nothing to us. You might ask, well, so what? Who cares what Israel did or didn't do in those places? But they are significant to us because we can be exactly the same. Now, we're all human here. Human nature is to try to make life as easy for ourselves as it possibly can be. You know, that has been probably the defining pattern for the advance of technology throughout the ages, is that we want to make life easier for ourselves. Now, normally that's a good thing, I think. Really, we want to make complex tasks simpler to perform. So you think of something like a washing machine, right? The simple washing machine. What that can do is can take an entire day's labor for a person, hard work, and turn it into a simple task that a machine can do by itself unsupervised. At the 8:30 service this morning, I had some great stories on the way out of those who remembered stirring around in copper tubs of hot water. You know, compared to that, the washing machine is a brilliant invention that makes hard work simpler. We love making life simpler, don't we? And usually making life simpler is a good thing. It frees us up to do more worthwhile things. But sometimes we can apply it to things that are unhelpful. Now, we naturally, subconsciously, because this is our approach to life, we want to make life easier, we want to make life simpler, we can apply that principle to our faith. But that doesn't work. We want to make faith easier. We want to make knowing Jesus easier. But there's a problem inherent in that. You can make a task easier through simplifying it. You can't make a relationship work by simplifying the process. But that's how we naturally think. We think, well, we want to work out what's the simplest way, how can I break down this task of knowing God, of knowing Jesus? And we think, well, the easiest way is to make ourselves feel as though we're being more religious. And the best way to do that is to create a place where we can feel like we're doing something religious. Now, that's the danger that Amos is speaking into here. And this is the problem that Israel are facing. Now, there's also a lot of idolatry. They're serving all nature of foreign gods as well. He'll delve into that elsewhere. But what he's doing here is he is saying to Israel, the things you do to make yourself feel closer to God are driving you away from him, because there is no substance, there is no heart, no core to it. Israel is saying, well, Bethel is the place where we go to meet with God. So if we build a temple there, if we put some statues in there, if we go and offer a few prayers every so often, well, bingo, that means that we've ticked those three boxes and now we have a relationship with God. How might we do that? What might we, as 21st century Christians, put in place that might give us a sense of doing something religious without having a relationship with our God? Well, I think in part it depends on what you think a relationship with God looks like. And each of us is wired differently. We want different things for our experience. For a traditional Christian, for someone who's influenced by those high church traditions of the 18th and 19th centuries, we might be drawn towards the cathedral as being a significant place. You know, surely we would say in this kind of architecture, we can have a deeper experience of God. Or any church building, we might say, where we can have a meeting around a table, you know, significant church furniture like this one or the even more ornate one that we have up the back there. You know, those things might make us feel as though we're doing something more religious. It might be the trappings of church that make us feel more religious. It might be the stained glass windows depicting those beautiful scenes, or the polished silverware. I think we've put it all away now. We had it out this morning. It might be priests in robes. Rick's definitely got rid of his robe this morning. It's probably hard to play a trumpet in one of those. You know, those are the things from a traditional background that can make us feel as though we're doing religious things. But it's not just traditional backgrounds. We can't just pick on one group. There are all manner of different things. If you're from a more casual background, you might get caught up in other things. You might love the feeling of an experience of God. So you might love to come to a place where the right kind of music is played, where the songs carry the right tune or sort of swell to give you that sense of the presence of God, or have the right words, or you might like a place with the right lighting that makes you feel like you can have an emotional response to God. Or you might be someone who likes to think that an intellectual experience gives you that sense of being religious. If you feel as though your brain has been stretched and you've learnt new facts about God or about the Bible, then your worship has been useful. Now, all of those things can give us a sense of experiencing God, but that feeling may or may not be real. And this is the hard part, because none of those things are bad things in themselves. There's nothing wrong with the cathedral. There's nothing wrong with a traditional service. There's nothing wrong with a modern service. They're not bad things, but they can be distracting things. They can lead us to go through the motions of faith without ever really engaging with God. And they can make us incredibly uncertain. You see, we do these things to make ourselves feel more religious, but we're never sure. We're never sure if we've met God. We're never sure if we're in his good books. But we want that confidence, don't we? Don't we really want to know that we're getting life right? That we're getting God right? That we know him and we're known by him? Now, we look at that kind of list of things that people do to try to spiritualize our place. It's easy to dismiss the ones that don't apply to us and say, well, they're silly, they're foolish, but the ones that we have are somehow more superior, as though our way of going about worship is somehow foolproof and guaranteed to lead us to God. That's not necessarily true. How can we know that what we're doing is bringing us closer to God? How can we know that we know God and are known by God? I mean, we can have confidence in what we're doing, but Israel had confidence in what they were doing. That's what we're going to read here in Amos 4 and again next week in Amos 5. They were going through the motions of religion week by week. Have a look at the second half of verse 4 that we'll get up there. Bring your sacrifices every morning, your tithes every 3 years. Burn leavened bread as a thank offering. Brag about your freewill offerings. Boast about them, you Israelites, for this is what you love to do, declares the sovereign Lord. Now, out of that, aside from the bragging and the boasting, those are the right things for Israel to be doing according to the law. He's not speaking about idolatry here. So what's the problem? The problem is not their action. Their problem is a heart that would rather be seen to be doing the right things than genuinely engage with God. That's their problem, that they are people who would rather be seen to be going through the right motions and looking religious than to genuinely engage with their God. A 21st century version might run something more like this. Here we go, Amos 4, 4 and 5, sort of. Bring your family every Sunday morning, your tithes during the second or fourth song, depending on which service you come to. Sip your coffee afterwards as a thanks offering. Brag about how moral we are, because this is what you love to do, declares the Sovereign Lord. Our question, our challenge that we take from Amos 4 is, what are the marks of a real believer? What demonstrates a faith that can show us that we are right with God, that we know God and are known by God? You see, sometimes we can look back at those people from biblical times and we can say, how could they believe that those simple things they were doing, things like getting circumcised, things like obeying a few laws, making a particular offering, doing some kind of devotion, how could they think that those things could guarantee a relationship with God? But we do the same thing. We say, oh, well, I got baptized. I made a confession of faith when I was a teenager. I perhaps got confirmed. I come to church every week, or most weeks, or when it works. I take communion every time that it's offered. And we say, well, surely I do those things. I'm on the inside. You know, we know that salvation is not by works. We know that we're not saved by the good deeds that we do. But we're still looking for signs that can show us the difference between insiders and outsiders, because we think, well, if we can do all of those, then we know that we're on the inside. But going through the motions of faith without a genuine relationship with God will always be empty. And in fact, going through the motions of faith without the substance of faith can be worse than being an open atheist. Because the thing is, an open atheist knows that they don't know God. Someone who's going through the ritual of faith without the substance of faith might think that they're right with God without ever having met him. It's hard to break through that shield, that defense of self-confidence. That's what God's been doing with Israel for a long time. And in fact, that's what he says in the next part of Amos's accusation there. He tells them that all those warning signs were there. He runs through it. He says, I've given you empty stomachs, droughts, blights, mildew, military defeat, all kinds of things to get your attention generation after generation, but the result is always the same. Still, he says, you have not returned to me. Now, we have to be careful here, because our temptation as rich Western believers will be to associate success in life or comfort in life with divine favor. You see, we'll look back at Israel and say, oh, well, God did all of those things to punish them because they were bad people. None of those things are happening to us, which means we must be good people, which, you know, seems logical, doesn't it? But it would be naive to believe that we are somehow above the suffering that happens to the rest of the world, as though we were superior, as though the curse of sin that affects our whole world somehow applies to other people, but not to us. Now, certainly, following God's way of life does spare us from a lot of the heartbreak that many people do face in this earth, but it is no guarantee that it will protect us from any kind of suffering in our lives. And it's important that we don't think that, because if we think that way, if we think that comfort in life is a sign of God's reward of our good religious behavior, it can lead us to turn on God when things go against us, as though we're thinking, if I go through the motions of faith, if I do the right religious things, then God owes me a good life. I know we might not put it that crudely, but that's how we can echo the attitudes of Israel. If I go to church, I think, well, God owes me something in return. I've done what he wants, now he can do what I want. Now, that's not how it works. Israel's failure is the failure to recognize their need for God. It's a failure to recognize their dependence on God. And it's a failure to know their God as he's revealed himself to them. They pushed him to the side. They went through the motions of faith without the heart, without the substance, without meeting God. And now God says he is going to come to meet them. But it's not going to be a happy meeting. He moves back into the courtroom for the final scene of the passage. And now the judge comes to give the final verdict. And that final verdict, that final sentence, is that God himself will come in judgment against those people. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the story of Job. in the Old Testament. Job is a fairly long book. Job is the one who had all of his wealth, all of his family stripped away from him. And he spends 30 or 40 chapters trying to convince anyone who's left that will listen to him that if only he could have an audience with God, then he would prove himself right. Things would be different. If God would just deign to come and meet him face to face, he thinks, well, I've got a few questions that I want to ask God about the way that I've been treated. That's what Job says. And I think that many of us can sympathize with Job from time to time. I think many of us look at the pain, the suffering that happens in the world, in the lives of our friends, our loved ones, in our own lives, and we might be tempted to think, well, if I was in charge, I could do better than this. But the thing is, when Job does meet God at the end of that book, when he comes to see who God was and that God isn't as he thought he was, he is absolutely terrified. He recognizes that God is so much bigger than he is. And he recognizes his need to come before God in humility and to meet God on his terms, God's terms, not his own. Israel is about to meet God in judgment. We don't want to meet God like Israel does. Now, they've had the chance to know God in love, to serve God in love. They pushed him to one side. They went through the religious behavior instead of that relational behavior with God. We don't want to meet God like Israel. Because if we meet God like Israel, if we meet God like Job, it won't be us holding God to account for the way that he has carried himself. It'll be the other way around. God doesn't owe us for our good behavior. God calls us to respond to him as our God, our Maker, and our King. Now, each one of us is mortal. Each one of us one day will die. Each one of us will one day have to give an account for ourselves. And we know, don't we, instinctively, that the way that we live matters. Each of us knows that there are good ways of living and there are not ways of living that are not good. So many of us, though, stumble around hoping that we get it right. We know that we should live a good life. We'd like to think that God will be happy with us, whether we think that because, you know, we've done the right things at church or we've always been nice to the neighbours or we've generally been good people. And so we hope that God will be happy with us at the end. But we don't have to wait till the end. Now, that's the tragedy of Israel. We don't have to wait like Israel did, only to find out that they had the whole thing wrong. Christian hope is not about stumbling around in the dark and hoping that at the end of it all, God will be pleased with us. Christian hope is a certain hope. It's a hope that's based on a meeting and a relationship with the one who can bring us to God. We're going to have a look at the last verse, one last verse, which is taken from the New Testament in 1 John chapter 1, verse 1. John, who disciple of Jesus, wrote John's gospel, wrote the letters of John, writes this about knowing Jesus and knowing God. He writes, "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life." John is talking about the substance of the Christian faith, not the form of the Christian faith. And John says, God is not distant. God is not abstract. God is not this strange mystery that we can't really ever know anything about. He says, God is a real God who has made himself known in his Son. John and those who were privileged like John to meet Jesus in the flesh says he is that which we have seen with our own eyes, who we've looked at, our hands have touched. We might know him. We can know God because God has made himself known to us. That is the heart of the Christian life. Now, the rest of it is here to point us towards God. All those traditions that we have, all those forms of church, of worship, all the rest of it, is there to serve that one truth, that we might come to know God more deeply, personally, through his Son. That's the Christian life. It's an invitation to know Jesus personally as we meet him in prayer, as we model our lives on His, and as we look to share what we've found with others. That's the answer to empty religion. That's the answer to an empty, baseless hope. That's the content, the substance of our faith. So why don't we pray? Father, we do give you great thanks that you are a God who loves his people, who loves his creation. We thank you for this gift of life. We thank you for the depth of your love. That means that you would chase us, you would pursue us, no matter how far we run from you. Lord, we pray that you will help us to see through any of those things that might deceive us into going through the motions of just doing the pattern of religious behavior. And help us to see you. Help us to know you, to hear you as you speak to us, as you love us, as you lead us. Lord, help us to respond to you by faith. Help us to encourage each other as we go about it day by day. And help us to know you and long for that day when we will see you face to face. Amen.